I was traveling with the FC Chorus, and I was staying overnight with some people I didn't previously know at all. And as we went into their house, just inside the entrance to the house was a cubby with shoes in them. And the host family immediately took off all their shoes and they placed them on the shelves. I didn't need to be told. I was just glad my socks didn't have holes in them. But I knew that was important. I stayed at another home with some friends on, with some people on a friend's trip. I was traveling with the friends. And as we went in the house, the woman kicked off her shoes, but the man just walked right on in with his on. And so I kept my shoes on. Not because I was following the man particularly, because I'm a man, he's a man, although in their house that may have been something. But I realized that something somebody was doing, but it wasn't necessarily an example that I had to follow. So there are some everyday skills and some very practical things that we have probably learned by following somebody else's example. We understand how examples teach us. So we watch a YouTube video and we learn how to sew. We play a game called Follow the Leader and we do whatever it is the leader does. It's an unspoken, unwritten rule. We learn how to place our fingers on the fret of a guitar by watching another guitarist do that. And we learn how not to do some things by seeing the consequences of wrong actions. Those are all ways we learn by example. Just example. So why do you think it is that God reveals his will for us sometimes in examples instead of or in addition to directives? I'm using directives as opposed to just commands. Why do you think, and I'll take your thoughts and I'll rephrase them for our brethren at the annex. Why do you think it is that sometimes God wants to teach us his will just by examples that are given? Any ideas? Any thoughts about that? Yes, Roger. Okay. All right. Roger says, I will remember what I've seen and what I've observed. You know, certainly it is sometimes easier to just show somebody how to do something than it is to try to tell them how to do that, isn't it? Sometimes easier. Any other thoughts? Is that, yep. What do you got, Todd? Okay, good. Sometimes giving some general idea by an example that's offered is easier than giving specific details. Can you imagine what the Bible would look like if it was only a book of commands and directives? First of all, would you read it? You know, it's sometimes amazing when our Congress, whether it's state legislatures or national legislatures, they pass bills and somebody will ask a congressman or a senator, have you read this? And it's like 1,700 pages there. It's not only incredibly thick and detailed, but it's probably boring as anything you've ever read. No, haven't read it. The Bible wasn't written to be a law book or a book of just commands for us. Much of what we learn in the Bible, we learn by example. We see somebody else doing something and it works for them. Maybe it works in practicalities. Maybe it works in their relationship with God. Or maybe it doesn't work in their relationship with God. And we say, well, I don't want to do that. I'm not going to go there. Or I'm going to do that way because it worked for them. So the Bible often teaches us by example because it's a good way to learn. Examples may be softer in instructing us. You know, the people in that house, when I went into that first house, they could have said, well, first of all, they could have put a sign on the door that says, no shoes beyond this point, exclamation point, skull and crossbones. They could have said, as I walked in the door, take your shoes off and put them in that bin. But they didn't have to do that. Their example showed me, and it was softer, gentler way of telling me, Ralph, take your shoes off in the house. That's what we do in this house. But examples sometimes are clearer. As Todd said, sometimes it's, if you just do what I do, it's easier to understand. Look, I could probably describe for you how to walk the dog with a yo-yo. I could probably go through that. We used to do this exercise in Toastmasters where we would put two people back to back and we would give one person a package of gum or something that had to be opened, and we would tell the other person, they have a pack of gum, they are going to follow your directions explicitly. So tell them how to open that package of gum. And of course, it was humorous because somebody would say, well, tear off the top. And the person on the other side would just rip the whole top off of the gum. And they would say, no, oh, no, that's not right. Well, take the cellophane. The other person doesn't know what cellophane is. You haven't told them. It's a clear outside wrapping. It goes on and on. Sometimes just showing somebody. If I told you, you have to wind the yo-yo and you have to wind it loosely and then you have to hold it so that when it comes out of your hand, it comes naturally off of the hand, and then you throw it down and turn your hand, it would take me ages to teach you how to throw a yo-yo and walk the dog. But I could show you in probably 2 or 3 minutes. Examples do that sometimes. They give us that information very clearly. But both, I want to tell you something. Both examples and commands or directives require thinking. You have to think, is that command applicable to me? Is it applicable to me right now or at all times? I was in Jonesboro, Tennessee. The National Storytelling Festival is there. And there was a sign on the wall of a business there out in the public. And it said, spitting on the sidewalk is forbidden. I knew that didn't apply because Jonesboro is a town that revels in its past, and they still have on the streets all kinds of paraphernalia and references to their old, earlier days. So there are rings for the reins of horses to be tethered, and there are still stepping stones, big blocks of rock where you step up on it so that you can mount a horse. I realize, by the way it was written and all, that's kind of a throwback. It's something they pride themselves in. I don't imagine if I had spit on the sidewalk, I would have been arrested at all. I'll give you the other side of the coin. Calvin Coolidge invited some guests for dinner at the White House, and they were very nervous about etiquette at the White House, so they determined they would just do whatever Calvin Coolidge did. And they followed him through the meal. When he picked up a fork, they picked up that fork. When he picked up a knife, they picked up that knife. They followed him all the way through the meal. Afterwards, they were going to have dessert and coffee. They brought the coffee in saucers, set it down in front of everybody. Coolidge immediately took some milk, a little pitcher of milk. He took his coffee cup off and he poured milk in the saucer. Everybody else grabbed the milk, poured it in their saucers, and then Coolidge put his saucer on the floor to feed his cat. Not every example's binding. Not everything applies to us. So we have to use our minds. And if you're thinking, well, this authority matter, Ralph, gets pretty complex, and maybe If we just had everything specifically told to us, we wouldn't have any problems. If what you're saying is, I don't want to think, God didn't speak to us that way. He wants you to think. He wants you to consider. He wants you to determine what is right and what is wrong for us. So rather than asking the question, when is an example binding on us? When do I, by binding, I mean, when is an example something I have to follow? Maybe the better question to begin with is God intending to show me something with this example? That's the best place to begin. Is God attempting to show me something with this example? Coolidge wasn't attempting to show his guests anything with his example of pouring milk into a saucer. My guess is if you had gone to the White House and seen Coolidge four or five times at dinner, he would have done the same thing over and over again. But it doesn't mean so this is something everyone should do. We need to look at the examples of the Bible, the things that are told us, and make determinations based on that question. Is God trying to tell me something with this example? Show me something. It may be something the apostles had done or something the early disciples did. And it is recorded for us in the Word. Now, I will say that should make us always stop and think. If God thought it was important enough to put it in the Word and to give us details about that, we ought to at least think about it before we say, no, that's not for me today. So the next question that was asked of you on the worksheets for you to at least think about is the question, what does Paul mean in 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 13, with this phrase, hold to the pattern of sound words? I'm going to read it from the New American Standard, which does not give that same rendition, but I think it does give that same thought. 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 13. Retain the standard of sound words, which you have heard from me, in the faith and love which are in Christ Jesus. I do like this word, pattern. The pattern of sound words. Because the Bible does speak of patterns. So somebody, just tell me quickly your own definition. What is a, how would you define a pattern? Anybody? A pattern. Anybody? A blueprint? Something that repeats? Something laid out for us that we are then determined to follow, like a blueprint or a pattern, something that we do the same way every time. Here's how you flip flapjacks. Here's how you do that over and over and over again. It's something you follow. You almost always have patterns that are seen or heard that you are to repeat. Todd?
Like a form or a set of instructions or a recipe, something that always creates the end result.
Oh, good, good. A form or a recipe or something that always creates the result you're looking for. I like that very much. So look, does the Bible speak to us in examples that are patterns? And I would say, yes, it does. The Greek word for pattern or standard in the New American Standard I just read is the word tupos. And it means a form, an example, or a pattern. And it is found 16 times in the New Testament alone. 16 times in the New Testament alone, we're called to a pattern or example or a form. And then I asked the question, does God take patterns seriously? I mean, is that something that really matters to him? And I've given you a lot of passages, and we're not going to read all of those in the interest of time. That's why I gave them to you for you to look at later. But yes, I would suggest to you, the Lord takes those patterns very seriously. In Acts chapter 7, verse 44, our fathers had the tabernacle of testimony in the wilderness, just as he who spoke to Moses directed him to make it according to the pattern which he had seen. God showed Moses a pattern of the tabernacle. He gave it to him. I don't know when and how and whether he had that in writing or what, or it was in a vision or just the words, but God said, here is what the tabernacle should look like. And he is told to make that tabernacle according to the pattern. God does work in patterns. In Hebrews chapter 8, verse 5, it's even sterner there. It says, who serve as a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. Listen, just as Moses was warned by God when he was about to erect the tabernacle, for see, he says, see that you make all things according to the tupos, the pattern, which was shown you on the mountain. Notice what it said. He warned him to follow the pattern he had given. So in Romans chapter 6, verse 17, you became obedient to that tupos or form of teaching to which you were committed. A form of teaching, not just specific directives, but a general pattern or idea of how we're to live. In Philippians chapter 3, verse 17, Paul says, join in following my example. Follow my example and observe those who walk according to the pattern you have in us. And 1 Thessalonians chapter 1, verse 7, you became an example, a tupos, to all the believers in Macedonia and Achaia. You became a pattern or an example. In 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 12, show yourself an example of those who believe. 1 Peter 2:21, Christ suffered for you, leaving you a tupos, an example to follow in his steps. An example to follow in his steps. And then 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 3, the shepherds are told to prove to be examples to the flock. So, let me give you now, let's kind of bring it to a close. Our time's almost up. To two particular areas where examples become very important. The partaking of the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week. And I want to say this, and there may be people here in the audience who would say, well, that's exactly me, what you just described. But there are people who would say, I don't think we have to take the Lord's Supper only on the first day of the week. It's a good thing to do. If it's good to do on Sunday, it's good to do any day. Or if you can't do it on Sunday, do it on a day you can do it. I don't think it's binding that we take it on the first day of the week. I'm going to disagree with that. I'm going to disagree respectfully, but I'm going to disagree with that. I believe the example in the Bible is not just, well, we can do it or not do it. It's pretty clear. This is, in my opinion, it's pretty clear that this is one of those areas where God has spoken and might very well say to us, as he did to Moses about the tabernacle, I'm warning you, I gave you example of what you're to do. This is not something you do when you want to do it, how you want to do it, where you want to do it, and the manner you want to do it. I've given you clear examples of what I want. Why would you ignore those? Why would we ignore what God is saying to us? It's at our peril, I think, that we do so. So what do we learn about the Lord's Supper? Let's take it in the increments in which it's offered, because it isn't given to us as a series of directives or commands. It's mostly given to us as a series of examples. So in Acts chapter 2 and verse 42, this is chapter 2. This is right after the New Testament church has begun. It's been established just a few verses earlier. And the disciples are trying to figure out what to do with their lives and how they are to interact with each other. So it says in verse 42, they were continually devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching and to prayer and to fellowship and to the breaking of bread. Now, it seems to me pretty obvious in that context, the breaking of bread is not about sharing meals together, because that would seem to fall more under the category of fellowship. If that's not the kind of thing fellowship is, I'm not sure I understand what that one is. But the breaking of bread is often used as a descriptive of the taking of the Lord's Supper. I realize it does have a general sense that there are passages that talk about breaking bread together. But in this context, where breaking bread together would indicate relational connection, that seems much more to fall under the heading of fellowship than it does just straight eating together. So if sharing meals together, like some of you, maybe many of you will do after we're concluded here today, if that's breaking of bread and that's fellowshipping together, sharing life together, then what is the breaking of bread? Is it really mentioned twice in the same context? I don't think so. So what do we know from that? Well, from the very beginning, we understand the disciples were devoted to it. If that's all we had, if that's the only passage we had, I'd be perfectly comfortable with us doing that as often as we want to do it. Let's devote ourselves to it tomorrow. And by the way, some of us are going to get together Wednesday. Let's devote ourselves to the breaking of bread Wednesday. Would you like to do that? If that's all we had, but it's not. It isn't all we have. In Acts chapter 20, verse 7, it says, on the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread. What was the purpose of their gathering together? It was to break bread. When did they do that? On the first day of the week. Now, that's not a command. That's an example. On the first day of the week, those disciples at Troas gathered together to break bread. They did that on the first day of the week. If your boss said to you, you get paid every week, and payday is Monday, you would conclude every Monday you're going to get paid. That's the day of payday. And you wouldn't be upset if he didn't pay you on Thursday or Friday. On the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread. Listen, anybody saying, well, I don't think it really matters what day it is, has to wrestle with this example. Does it mean something? Well, it was the day of the resurrection. It appears to be a pretty consistent pattern that that's when the disciples assembled to partake of the bread. And I'm going to go a little further with that. Because if you read all that in the context, folks, Paul is trying to get to Jerusalem for the Passover. And Troas is nowhere near Jerusalem. He's got a long journey to make with possible breaks and stops and delays in getting to Jerusalem. But it says when he got there, he was with them 7 days. Why is he there with them 7 days? If he's in a hurry to get there, why 7 days? Because the very next verse says, on the first day of the week, when the disciples had gathered together to break bread, Paul spoke to them. I think we can use some inference here that the reason that Paul stayed 7 days is because that's the day, the first day of the week, he could meet with all the disciples. That's when they were going to gather. And so he delayed. Oh, man, I just missed it. I got here on Monday. Oh, I got to stay 7 days. But the passage does say in that same chapter in verse 16, he was in a hurry to get to Jerusalem. And you know what else is interesting? If you go to chapter 21 of Acts, chapter 21, and you look at verse 4, it says there, after looking up the disciples, we stayed there 7 days. Why did he stay 7 days? Paul's got bad luck. He just keeps showing up on Mondays. And he stays 7 days. But remember, chapter 20 said he was hurrying to be in Jerusalem, if possible, on the day of Pentecost. And so he is delaying himself to be with them. And then you go to chapter 28 of book of Acts, and look at verse 14. There we found some brethren, and we were invited to stay with them for 7 days. And thus we came to Rome. Look, was there something about the New Testament church in 7 days? I don't think so. I don't think it was like the lucky day or after 7 days we won't keep you anymore. It's our rule. I think it was 7 days in these cases were what brought them to the first day of the week when they could assemble with the disciples. So what have we learned so far? Just from examples, not one command or directive has been given. Examples. Well, the disciples devoted themselves to the breaking of bread. It was very important to them. It wasn't a give or take thing. They devoted themselves to it. It's in the same context as devotion to the word, as devotion to prayer, as devotion to fellowship. And when did they do that? Well, they evidently devoted themselves to it on the first day of the week. It was so important, Paul didn't even say, hey, I'm here on Monday. Could we just do this on Tuesday? Could we all gather then and take the Lord's Supper together? No, because we gather on the first day of the week to partake of the Lord's Supper, Paul. And Paul said, I know that. I do too. And he does it at Troas. And he does it again and again, 3 times in the book of Acts. And then we learn something else. When we go to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and we look at verses 16 and 17, it says, is not the cup of blessing which we bless a sharing in the blood of Christ? Is not the bread which we break a sharing in the body of Christ? Since there's one bread, we who are many are one body, for we all partake of the one bread. So here's the point here. I'm going to say something. I'm not saying you're wrong. It's not my place to tell you this. That you're wrong if you ever take the Lord's Supper on your own in the car driving or on a boat somewhere, or you're just at home, that you can take the Lord's Supper, or you want somebody to bring it to you because you're sick and you want to partake of the Lord's Supper. I'm not saying you're wrong in doing that, but that's not the pattern of the New Testament. The pattern of the New Testament was, this was to be done as a sharing exercise with the people of God. It's very clear. That's what they just said. Is it not a sharing? Is it not something we do together? And that in fact is strongly suggested in chapter 11, where he says in verses 17, 20, and 33, you guys aren't waiting for each other. You're just doing your thing with the supper of the Lord whenever you want to do it. And you can't do that. You can't do that. This is something to be done together as the people of God. So, there are some other examples about the Lord's Supper. For example, it's mentioned twice in the location. It was done in an upper room. The Lord celebrated it in an upper room, and the disciples at Troas celebrated that in an upper room. We know that because that's where Eutychus fell out of the window and died. And it was taken after sundown, reckoning time by Jewish time. And it's probably likely they, in many cases, they shared a cup. Now, does that mean, well, there's some examples, Ralph. Does that mean we should take it in an upper room and that it should be only after sundown, not while the sun is up, and that it should be done with one cup, one container or vessel? Well, I asked you the question earlier. I think we need to ask the question. Is God trying to teach us something by these examples in the particulars? So, for example, go back to the opening illustration. I go in the house. I see the woman of the house, and she kicks off this shoe and then kicks off this shoe, and she picks them up and puts them in a bin. Do I say, oh, let's see, what foot was it first? Oh, yeah, it was the left foot first. And then the right foot, and then pick them up and put them in the bin. There, I've done the right thing. Would the woman of that house say, yes, you did? Or would she say, you're a little too particular, persnickety about that. I wasn't trying to imply anything by that. Is God trying to imply something about the upper room or about after sundown? I don't think so. I mean, I could be wrong and you might teach me, but I don't think he's trying to teach us anything by that. I think those are just what we would call incidentals. But I am not at a point of saying, yeah, in the first day of the week, that was an incidental. I mean, it's pretty clear they're making a point of the first day of the week. So I'm going to tell you something. And I know I speak for the eldership here. Don't bring us a suggestion that we start offering the Lord's Supper on Saturday night. It is not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Because we believe that example is important for us. We believe God's trying to teach us something by the tupas, the example or form of teaching. And that same thing is true about the plurality of elders in every church. Those passages I gave you, you go back and read them. Elders, plural, in every church, singular. And then it also says that you're to be elders among which God has given you oversight. This church and its shepherds will never oversee the work of another church. Never. Because we must be dwelling among the people we oversee. We live among them. So no satellite churches here where we're overseeing what's happening over in, down in Sarasota or over in Thanodosassa or Antioch. That won't happen. If those churches exist, we will not oversee them because that is not the pattern we see in the New Testament. Examples are important. Don't overlook them. Don't ignore them. Don't go to extremes with them or think that by pointing out extremes, you can negate the valid examples of the Bible. Our time's up. We'll stand adjourned. Next week, we will talk about silence and what it says. Hello, darkness, my old friend. We'll talk about that next week. Thanks for being here.